Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
I do love how they ragdoll all those bodies. Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
I mean, am I crazy? Huh? I mean, this is all I am trying to say here, okay? If you put me in the game, Brad Bramish is going to do what needs to be done.
This is Recotopia, Episode 3. I'm Chris Atkinson.
And I'm Jeremy Scott.
That's right. And today, our big recommend is going to be Brick, but we're going to get into some other smaller recommends and everything. But anyway, hi, chat. How's everybody going? How's everybody doing? You have a good weekend?
Did you find your dad?
Yeah, did you find your dad?
All right, who wants to start off with small recommends this week?
Oh, well, you go. Go ahead with your small recommend.
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
I'm going to go on with my bad self, and I'm going to recommend a movie that I believe most of the world considers bad.
Okay.
I'm going to recommend The Incredible Burt Wonderstone.
I kind of have a soft spot in my heart for this one, too.
Yeah. I had seen it. Yeah, it came out in 2013. I'd seen it a couple times back then, but it's been running on one of the movie channels lately, and I've probably seen it maybe two times in the last week. And I can find few flaws. I think I understand why people don't like it. It's a 38 on Rotten Tomatoes, which is not good. Not good at all. But I can't help wonder if this is one of those movies that eventually we'll decide we got wrong when it came out. I find Jim Carrey's performance to be one of his very funniest performances of all time.
Yeah.
He plays a what's the name of the guy? He's Chris Angel, I guess.
It's a Chris Angel type of thing.
Like a street magician, but his tricks are all ludicrously, awesomely funny.
Yeah.
He tells a guy to pick a card and put it back in the deck after writing his mom's name on it. And then he says, punch me in the face. And he basically goads this guy into punching him in the face. And then out of the cut, he pulls the card with the mom's name on it. It's so absurd. Olivia Wilde is in this. She's very dry, very funny. Fucking Alan Arkin is in this. And he's hysterical. And even Jay Moore. It's just a cast full of people. I haven't even mentioned that it's basically Steve Carell and Steve Buscemi playing Las Vegas main stage magicians who've gone stale. And this Jim Carrey magician is stealing, Steve Gray is his name. He's stealing all the popularity and thunder. And so James Gandolfini, who owns the casino, basically challenges them, hey, you got to come up with a better show. And they do this ridiculously dumb stunt where they plan to hang in a glass box for 7 days. They make it like 7 minutes. And then they have a falling out. They're not friends anymore. I'm not going to spoil the whole plot to you, but I laugh consistently throughout this movie. I think it has a little bit of heart. It's ridiculous, especially the ending. It's if we ever sinned this movie, we'd probably add 1,000 sins for that final trick that they do, which is also criminal as hell. But
yeah.
I do love how they ragdoll all those bodies. Throw them into the trucks. Oh, man. I love this movie. I can't figure out what it is that made it get such bad reviews when it first appeared. You said you have kind of a soft spot. When was the last time you saw it?
Yeah, it was in theaters. I was working at Hollywood 27 when this came out, and there's a moment that I really enjoy in this because, you know, the Carell and Buscemi have this act that requires two people. And when Buscemi leaves the act in the middle of the movie, Carell tries to go on and do the same thing. And like, he's on stage doing all this stuff that requires two people and everything. And it's just, it hits me right in the funny bone for it. And the Jim Carrey stuff. And is this the one also where is there an old magician that they follow? Like who plays that?
That's Alan Arkin.
Alan Arkin, yeah.
He was the one that inspired them to become magicians when they were kids, and now he's in a nursing home, and they reinvigorate each other's love of magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's really funny. I love when Buscemi quits magic and goes down to like the rainforest to give out magic kits to indigenous kids.
Yeah.
And then later when he comes back, he's like, it turns out they didn't want magic. They just wanted food and clean water.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you have ever heard my recommendations on a previous podcast or in general, you think you know my taste well enough to know what you're getting into, this is two thumbs up for me. I laugh very hard at this movie, and screw the critics.
Yeah. I can see that. And we all have those, don't we? Like, and you know, it all comes down to how these things hit you a lot of times. And, and for some people, those various things that we just mentioned are, you know, comedy, you know, whatever, comedy, comedy disease, I guess, you know, like that's not funny at all. But, I'm going to do something similar because, the IMDb has this show that I just watched at a 6.4. So a lot of people weren't enjoying this, but I really liked it. And it is, I'm going to read this off here. The Woman in the House Across the Street from the Girl in the Window, which is Kristen Bell. And it's a sort of a take on The Girl on the Train and The Woman in the Window and all those type of movies where women are seeing things, but they have an alcoholic problem and they may not be seeing those things. And they have all these other, you know, everything is heightened melodrama. But in this one, everything is played completely straight, except for maybe like one or two instances where they really do seem to kind of wink at you a little bit, which I would have been fine if they didn't. But I think they occasionally do that because some producer probably was like, come on, guys, we're playing this so straight. Can we give anything to the audience here that we're not being completely on the level? And so this is Kristen Bell. Kristen Bell is this woman who is divorced. Michael Ealy plays her ex-husband. They had a daughter who died. And you're gonna find out how she died later. And of course, the way they portray this, the way they just kind of very casually say how she died, and everything. I don't want to spoil anything about it, but is just like you can't believe your jaw is gonna drop like how casually they say this. But Kristen Bell has an aversion to rain and she can't go out in the rain without being just severely emotionally crippled and everything. So, of course, there's many moments in there where she'll run out and it starts raining and she just falls, crumples into a ball and everything. But the main story is, a new neighbor moves in across the street. She thinks that, maybe this is me and him can get together and everything. She's kind of feeling some vibes. He's got a young daughter. He apparently also lost his wife and it was another tragedy there. And so like, it's like, maybe, you know, this can happen. And then she finds out, he's got a girlfriend. And then the girlfriend, like she thinks that she sees the girlfriend get murdered one night. So this sets her in motion, this whole thing where she thinks she's seen this woman murdered. She starts uncovering things, thinks that maybe the man across the street is a murderer and looks into things so deeply that of course nobody believes her. There's a lot of characters involved here that could be the murderer. Then, but when she says that she sees this, everybody's telling her, no, she's not dead. She went to Seattle or whatever. So like, it's a whole like thing going on there where we don't know what to believe. She's an unreliable narrator or that type of thing. And there's so many moments where she's narrating and it's so purposefully overwrought, you know, like that just like has this kind of this, when she says it out loud, it sounds so stupid, but she says it so seriously that, you know, and so I can imagine that there were people who watched this going, is this serious? I don't know if this is serious or not. And really just picked up on the bad on everything and didn't give it the sort of the due that it, you know, but that's not for everybody. You know, I mean, there's so many things out there that if you don't get that kind of thing, this is not going to be for you at all. You know, it's too straight, I think, for some people to take as a comedy. And so Kristen Bell is great in this. You know, I it's amazing how many shows she's been in at this point. Veronica Mars and The Good Place. She's great in all of this stuff. We had somebody, was it Nick, that said that the show was funny, and then another person now is saying, and I'm sorry, is it Obina? I don't know. I don't want to like mess up the people's names, but the best thing about this show is how little of it needs to be over the top for it to still work as a parody. Yes, exactly. This is exactly how you make these type of things. You know, the one of the things that about the, and this is not getting into date movie and scary movie territory and all that type of stuff, but when you watch the one thing that they really took out of those, and there's a lot of things to be left to be desired in those movies, but they wink at everything. Everything is like mugging for the camera and like, oh, look how funny this is. You got to laugh at this, right? It's so funny.
Right.
And they don't realize how much funnier it is when you don't do that. And, and if they had made the woman in the house across the street from the girl in the window like that, where they were kind of just like telling real jokes in this, because I don't think there's any moment in here where somebody's trying to be funny. If they'd done that, I think that would have taken away from the ultra seriousness of the show. So anyway, I highly recommend it, even though it has only a 6.4 on the IMDb. If you like that kind of humor where they just don't let you in on it. They don't let you know that they're joking the entire time. This is for you.
Awesome. Well, that's quite a recommend. Now, I'm going to go off book. I apologize to you and our producer, Aaron, for going off script from the prep list today, but I want to
off the list.
Well, you know, I sent you what I was planning to do, and only one of them was a movie, and one was a cheese, and one was a pillow, and I don't really want to be the guy who's always recommending Mountain Dew and cheese and pillows and things like
that. You could be that guy, though.
I mean, it would very easily work for me, but I want to recommend a book that I've been reading on my Kindle, and I'm trying to pull up right now, and I am not very good with kindling. But the book is called, that's the copyright, Monster City, Murder, Music, and Mayhem in Nashville's Dark Age. I started reading this because I live in Nashville, but it's by Michael Artfeld, and it's about a cop who lived in Nashville and solved more cold cases in the 80s, solved more cold cases, period, than any other detective in American history. Like, tons and tons of cold cases, but also caught serial killers. And Nashville in the 70s and 80s was this bizarre hub for violent crime and serial criminals because of the way the interstates converged right there at downtown. They still do. And so it was very easy to just swoop into town, find a victim, and get right back out of town.
No kidding.
So this is a nonfiction book. This guy spent days and days and days interviewing this man. And I had no idea that this had gone on in Nashville's backyard. Now, I wasn't living here until 1998. So this was all before my time. But I'd never heard any of this story about this local cop who was basically like a guy out of a movie. And my hope is that eventually, if this continues the way it's been going, this book, maybe one day they'll make a movie out of it, because he's a fascinating guy, and just the way that he thinks, the way that cold cases are cold for a reason. They're nearly impossible to close, and this dude just comes along and just obliterates them, and it's fascinating. So that, I've already put the Kindle away like a moron, but the name of the book is Monster City, Murder, Music, and Mayhem in Nashville's Dark Age by Michael Arntfeld. And I suggest you check it out. I'm about two-thirds of the way through and have loved it.
What does it consider Nashville's Dark Age?
The age of when the killings took place. So basically the 70s and 80s.
Okay, 70s and 80s.
That streak of violent crime, yeah.
Mm, yeah.
All right, let's hear your second recommend.
The next recommend is Nightmare Alley, the Guillermo del Toro movie.
Nice.
I've seen the original. I watched the original. I like the original pretty well. I think I like this one better, and I don't know if it's just because it's just... I hate to say it, it's just more modern, and it's more colorful, and it's more... There's actors that I know in it, and, you know, things of that nature. Maybe that's what it is. I don't think there's too many differences between the Guillermo del Toro version and the older version, except that it looks way slicker, and they've changed a couple of plot elements that really didn't matter that much from the original. But this movie is beautiful to look at, and of course, I mean, that's the hallmark of all Guillermo del Toro movies. But it stars Bradley Cooper as a guy. We see him at the very beginning of this, putting a body down in the basement of a house and then burning the house. And then next thing you know, he's looking for work at the circus. So he's basically just doing menial tasks. You got people like Ron Perlman in here, and you got, you got Willem Dafoe and Rooney Mara are all working at this circus. Bradley Cooper does these jobs for a while. He falls in love with Rooney Mara. But Ron Perlman is there to say, no, you can't be making the sex with Rooney Mara, because I had a deal with my dad, with her dad, that I would protect her. So that means no sex ever. He starts getting interested in this one show that, what's her name? Oh no. Toni Collette. Toni Collette does this show, with her husband, David Strathairn, where they just do stuff, and it's crowd work, like the John Edwards almost, except it doesn't get. This is where the movie is headed, the John Edwards stuff. But, like, they stay away from all the like, you know, what they call the spook show. They're just looking for regular details about people's moms and parents. You know, just the, like, you know, is Thanksgiving important to you? You know, stuff like that. And he starts to, because David Strathairn is such a drunkie, the Bradley Cooper ends up having to sort of fill in a little bit. And then he starts to live with them. Basically starts hanging out with Toni Collette and David Strathairn. Toni Collette, has no qualms about coming on to Mr. Cooper, like as soon as the husband walks out the door. But he soon learns that there's a trick, there's a method to all this madness. Like, there's a very complex language that she and he are doing out in the crowd, like doing this crowd work. Basically he's underneath the stage feeding her information, but the show is not, that's not what Bradley Cooper wants to do. It's a different kind of show. It's an offshoot of that, basically, where you can go out into a crowd and like just say, you know, there's a P name, you know, whatever. Somebody's got a P name or whatever. And then, you know, you start gravitating towards people and everything. But it's a complex language that they tell each other. Everything means like a certain thing. Certain words mean certain other things, so that they can come up with the right answer for the people that they're doing in this show. So Bradley Cooper, after I'm not going to spoil too much, but there's a point where he takes Rooney Mara with him on to another show. He starts the show by himself, basically. And you can see he's super well dressed, and he's like well to do and everything. And he's got Rooney Mara helping him. And there's a show where she makes a mistake, and he starts to go into what we call the spook show, which people tell don't ever do this, because this starts getting dangerous, because people start wanting to. They start wanting to see their loved ones that have died and everything. But he can see the grift in all of this. He can see that, you know, you can make a lot of money doing this. And one night he runs into Kate Blanchett, who thinks that she can trip him up during a show. And he successfully turns the tables on her. But then he and Kate Blanchett come up with an idea. Why don't we find these wealthy people who have lost loved ones and do this to them and pretend like we can talk to their loved ones from beyond? And ultimately ending up on Richard Jenkins, who is really good in this movie. Richard Jenkins is sort of like, at all costs wants to talk to his long lost daughter in all this. This movie is really good, and it's one of those that by the end of it, with the very end shot, is going to make you feel the chills at the end of this. It rewards you for paying attention throughout once the ending of this happens. So I'm not the biggest of Guillermo del Toro fans. I have enjoyed many of his movies, but I've never been over the moon about them like a lot of people seem to get whenever he comes out with a new thing. But I think this one is well deserving of the accolades it's been getting.
I was talking to Patrick, who's on screen here, saying There Will Be Mentalism, because he said this movie reminded him of There Will Be Blood with some mystical shit. You're making me want to see it. When I talk to him, not so much, which is not on him. It does seem to be the kind of movie that some people really like and some people just don't enjoy. I've seen a lot of both kinds of takes, but I didn't know. The trailers did not do enough to tell me what this movie was about. I thought it was much more supernatural shit, and maybe it is at the end, but the whole idea of the mentalism stuff kind of intrigues me. And I like all these actors.
That's one thing that I will give this movie credit for, is it never once at all suggests that it could be real at all, ever. This is all a grift.
Okay.
I mentioned before, there is a particular trigger about 2 hours into this movie.
Right. I'll be giving the same warning later in the show.
It's really good. I was not expecting much out of it, and that could be part of why I'm a little higher on it than normal, is that I wasn't expecting anything out of this, and it turned out to be really great. One thing though that I was watching this is, what do we think of Rooney Mara these days? What is her career? When you look at her career, do we think she's great, or she seems to play this kind of role a lot? In this one, she's the wife who, she doesn't want to go to the lengths that Bradley Cooper is going in this. She likes doing the fun stuff that has nothing to do with death and everything. But she's always that voice of reason. Like, she does the girl with the dragon tattoo. That's maybe a different, that's an outlier, but everything else, it seems like she's the moral center of almost everything. Maybe I'm forgetting some movie.
In Social Network, she's kind of that.
That's what I kept thinking, was The Social Network. And I kept thinking of even her little moment in Her, where she shows up.
Yep.
Where she's just kind of like the wife and everything. And I just feel like she's better than this, but this is what the roles that she finds all the time.
Yeah. So, I agree. I think she's got talent. I'm just not sure we are getting to explore it. Like, the Dragon Tattoo performance suggests there's a lot more there than most of her movies are showing us. So,
yeah.
All right. You ready to move on to the big recommend?
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
I'm fine, I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
All right, so our combined recommend this week is Rian Johnson's Brick, which came out in 2005. This is Rian Johnson's directorial debut, actually. He had done several little shorts and things of that nature before this. But what I gathered from, you know, watching this, and I watched some of the commentary on this movie and all that, is that Rian Johnson was a big, huge Dashiell Hammett fan.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to make a movie, a film noir that's kind of like that, and how it ended up being high school students, you know, talking in this manner that they talk throughout and everything. I don't know exactly how that happened, but he decided to make this movie with, you know, kids who are still passable for high school age or whatever. Most of the people in this movie, if you look up, they're like all 24, except for Noah Segan, who's a little bit younger. But the basic story is this: Joseph Gordon-Levitt is a guy in high school who used to date this woman played by Emily DeRaven, and he gets a call from her on a payphone and she starts rattling off all of these words in a row that he doesn't quite understand. She says brick, she says the pen, she says all these different words that he's like, what? I don't even know what they mean. And by the next day, she's dead and he doesn't understand why. And he has his friend he calls him the brain. He's like throwing some theories off and trying to figure out who could be behind this, who could be the pen, all this stuff. What does the pen mean? What does brick mean? What does all these type of things mean? And he's sort of just thrust into this world of, like, it's normal high school stuff, but like filmed at this weird, like, different lens, different. I mean, there's a point where he keeps visiting Megan Good, who's always doing plays or something like that. She's always around the stage.
Always.
And she'll say, hey, go get this for me. And there's some dude from under the camera will come up, like, he's just been sitting there the whole time.
She calls him,
like her dog.
She calls him Lapdog. And then the rest of the movie, he just is there suddenly, occasionally.
Yeah. So he's trying to figure out this. He's trying to solve this murder, basically. He finds Emily DeRaven in this tunnel, out in the middle of nowhere, where this water is running through it. It's this real dingy place with a bunch of graffiti and everything. And he finds her, and he wants to figure out who's responsible. So he starts asking these people who he thinks it might have to do with, and it basically centers on drug dealers. And there's a lot of characters in this that he keeps on trying to find information from. One is Noah Segan, who is in every Rian Johnson movie, who plays a guy by the Pie in the Sky in Mai or something like that, some restaurant that's...
Yeah, the Pie in the Sky is the restaurant, and his character's name is Dode.
Yeah, Dode, that's right.
There's a lot of unique character names in this movie, but anyway, continue.
It's one of my favorite scenes in this, because he goes up to ask for information, and Dode is like, he's like basically saying, just stay away from this. You don't want to have any part of this. And he ends up punching him. Joseph Gordon-Levitt ends up punching Dode in the face, and there's a bunch of his guys are like sitting behind the dumpster, and he goes, hey, anyone a piece of this? I have all five of my senses, and I slept last night, which gives me six more than you guys. You know, something like that. It's this constant like finding it's just like any murder mystery noir type movie where he keeps on finding little details, and he goes after the detail, and then he finds even more people to ask things, and then there's some occasional confusing things that happen in the mm-hmm. movie, like actual plot confusing things. The dialogue itself is going to confuse you a lot, especially if you're not. Like I said, I watched this with subtitles. I would have never picked up on the fact that he was calling like bad guys or people of interest yeggs in this.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see that? He was calling people like, there's a point where he's in the vice principal's office, which by the way, played by Richard Roundtree, which is great.
Yes.
There's a point in there where he's like, you can't just be pulling me out of here and putting me in this room or everything. What if some just yegg found me? You saw some yegg saw me come in here or whatever. And I was like, what the fuck does he mean by yegg? And he's got
to
be
long enough to figure out what he meant by bulls. I did not know what he meant by
bulls
yeggs.
Were cops.
I figured that out, but it took me three or four times because a couple of sentences, it made it sound like he was referring to the principal and the VP. It's a lot of really interesting shit that he does
with
the dialogue and the setting, because they're all high school students, but almost none of this takes place in school. Sometimes they appear to be at school even though it's dusk. Like it's more of a part of the language, like the way that they say, who's he been eating with lately?
Yeah.
As part of like, you know, who's he hanging around with? Like, and, you know, they do spell it out to mean lunch, you know, who's he hanging out with at lunch, but it does carry a larger meaning than that. Who you been eating with lately? The language about this film is, I think, one of the most interesting things about it.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated that the detective work here is essentially ass beating one at a time. Either you beat ass or you get your ass beat, but it's always with a motive. It's all like he beats Dode's ass so that the other guy, the football player who apparently can't ever get to play, he will take notice. And so he does. And so then he fights that guy and beats his ass. And then one of the other guys comes for him and beats his ass. And it's all about getting the attention of the next higher up until he's finally in the room with the pin, and the pin says, you got my attention. I'm curious to see what you're going to say next.
That was the interesting thing about his fight with the football player. And God, I need to have this up, the IMDb up, so I can keep these character names.
Yeah, Brad.
Brad's his name. The reason why he gets in the fight with Brad, played by Brian White, you've seen him a million times, by the way. Mm-hmm. He's been in a ton of stuff. Reason why he does that is he wanted to see who would take notice of this. He knew that because what he saw was that nobody helped him out during this entire fight. And then it leads him to the next person. And like you said, it gets all the way to the pen. Played great, wonderfully by Lucas Haas.
Yeah, he's awesome.
And there's all sorts of nice little character touches in this. I love that scene where he picks him up in the van, and Joseph Gordon-Levitt is in this crooked position in the van, looking down at Lucas Haas, who's sitting there with a lamp next to him.
There's a lit lamp
in the van, and it's this conversation that takes place in this van. And then by the end of it, they let him out, and it's at the same place that he got picked up. It's like the circle, the pickup circle, basically. And the scene with the vice principal too, where this is sort of the tip offs, even though this is much like when I was talking about the woman across the street from the woman in the window, whatever the movie is called. They don't let in at all in this. There's nothing, any joke that's told in this, they don't let you in on it. But there's some moments in there that when they say things, it goes a little bit above what is normal. So like there's a point where he turns to Richard Roundtree and he says something to the effect of like, if you want to do something, otherwise I'll see you at the parent conference. And so all this typical school stuff and typical parent stuff, there's it keeps showing up. Like when he meets the Pen, they're like, they go upstairs and the Pen's mom is like, it's like, oh, what would you like to drink? I don't have any juice, it looks like. And they're sitting there like staring at each other with like a bowl of cereal in between them. And it's just, this movie is so incredibly unique. And I'm surprised that over the years, especially now that Rian Johnson has become this name director. And I know that a lot of people didn't like Last Jedi, although I think it's just one of the most divisive Star Wars movies ever made. Mm-hmm. Knives Out, everybody, I think, loved. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of surprised that we haven't gotten sort of a retro back to this movie where people are talking about it a lot. Just people it are talking about it a lot.
So unique that from what I could find, he wrote this right out of film school and couldn't get anybody to produce it because it was considered too unique for a first-time director.
Mm-hmm.
So he got the money from his family. And once his family put enough money up, a couple of other investors he knew put in the rest. But it took him years. It took him years of being rejected by money men because it's such a unique movie. And you by choosing this movie, you made my super secret double feature incredibly hard because it is such a unique film. There's almost nothing else like it. And that's, I think, why I enjoy it so much. It swings for the fences and it succeeds, I think, in being this sort of cross between, you know, high school, but mostly a modern homage to those detective novels and the film noir detective stories. I had seen it once before years ago. And so I watched it again last night in prep for this podcast and I was blown away. I thought the performances were all good. Especially Joseph Gordon-Levitt, because you think of Joseph Gordon-Levitt in this era as like the 10 things I hate about you, Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's as fun of a movie as that is. Nobody has to try very hard in that movie. Maybe Julia Styles in that one scene where she reads the poem. But this is not too far away from that era, and this is an incredible performance. He is as good or better than anyone in the film. My favorite anecdote I wanted to talk about is when he sees the black Mustang muscle car in an empty parking lot. And so he picks up this huge boulder and starts walking over to it, and he pulls it up because he's going to smash the window, and then he looks up and sees the guy, Tug, walking towards him, and he's like, okay, I don't need to break the window.
Never once gets into a run either. He walks this way the entire time over there.
The Terminator walks. I really enjoyed it. It's fresh, and you're right. I think it does deserve kind of a renaissance, especially after Knives Out.
The funny thing, too, before we got on here where you were talking about how Joseph Gordon-Levitt at the end explains everything all in that one shot.
It's beautiful.
There's a lot of scenes in the movie that take place on this football field. Eerily sort of reminiscent of The Breakfast Club and the way he shoots some of these, the angle of this, some of the angles of this football field. But it's this dirty, muddy football field that he has conversations on. And apparently he did this before. He had done this scene before. Where they came back, and when they started editing it, they realized that the sound was just terrible. And in fact, on the brick Blu-ray, you get to see the original, of this, and
that's awesome.
and it's all this one shot of like a circular shot going around this thing, but the sound is awful, and so they had to reshoot it like 8 months later. And apparently the football field had been just completely redone. Like it looked immaculate.
Oh, no.
So during that last scene, they had to shoot from down low so that you didn't see how pristine the field looked on that. So
that's fascinating. How many directors would share a mistake like that. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, he in the deleted scenes, he introduces all of them, and there's one where they had this big dream sequence where Emily DeRaven shows up from the sky or something, and he says something to the effect of like, when you watch this, you're going to be like, what were they thinking? You know, basically, because it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. We didn't mention Nora Zehetner, who plays the femme fatale in this, you've probably seen her before. She was in Heroes. If you ever saw Heroes, I can't remember what her power was in Heroes. Heroes is one of those shows that had like what, one good season, and then second season it fell off, and then third season he was like, oh, okay, we'll do something else, and it still didn't work. But that's where I remember her from. But she's been in a ton of stuff. Like, if you look at her credits, she's still working today. I think I saw her in an episode of Marin once when Mark Marin had his show. I think I'd seen her in some other thing. Of course, Megan Good. This is just not the type of movie you typically see Megan Good in. I love the fact that there's some actors in here that you wouldn't normally see in a movie like this that are in here. And Megan Good is great. That character is so memorable just from the fact that she's always around the stage and has all these lap dogs around. It's just crazy to me. But yeah, Joseph Gordon-Levitt is amazing. Lucas Haas is great. Brick is good. It is good.
So now it falls to me to deliver the super secret double feature.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Oh, which yes.
Was very difficult because, as I said, this movie is not like too many other movies. If I were to go by similar tone, I would almost have to choose another Rian Johnson film, like Knives Out or The Lookout.
He didn't do The Lookout.
Oh, he didn't direct The Lookout? Okay, just Joseph Gordon-Levitt was in that?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought he directed that.
No, I don't think so. I'll look it up real quick.
Well, anyway, that was another movie I thought of that maybe I should have made my super secret double feature because I'd eliminated it thinking it was a Rian Johnson film. I also thought about the obvious film noir stuff like Chinatown, I think would be a very nice double feature for this film. But I find myself, and I think you're going to be the same way, not wanting to make a conventional obvious choice when it comes to this. So I do want to tell you a few that I considered and why, and then I'm going to give you my presentation.
All right.
The first one I thought about was Donnie Brasco.
Yeah, I actually thought about this.
And there's a certain undercover element to part of Brick where he goes to work for the PIN for his own reasons. And the PIN doesn't necessarily trust him, but he's essentially undercover playing two roles there. I also thought about Disturbia because that's a high school aged film where there's a mystery that somebody's trying to solve. I like that movie more than most. I very, very nearly went with Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid.
Oh, yeah.
Where Steve Martin inserts himself into clips from obscure black and white film noir. But in the end, what I decided I wanted to go with, I feel like Brick is about love and loss and mystery. He and Emily DeRaven aren't even together anymore. But he obviously still loves her. And then he loses her. And there's a mystery to solve. And to hit all three of those notes, I've decided to go with The Virgin Suicide.
Ooh, that's a solid choice.
Thank you. I preface this by saying the movie is called The Virgin Suicides for a reason. There is suicide at the end of this movie, and if that's a trigger for you, you know, as it is for me these days, at least know that going in. The Virgin Suicides is from Sofia Coppola. Is that her debut as a director?
Believe so, yes.
I think this one came before
it
the
did.
One. Yeah, okay. So this is Kirsten Dunst. James Caan is the father, but there are a bunch of sisters who live in this really conservative Christian home and almost never leave the house. And The boys in town, specifically the neighbor boy across the street and his friends, are curious at first, and ultimately maybe a little obsessed with finding out, why don't they ever leave the house? What is up with their lives? What is so unique about it? Josh Hartnell is in this, and he plays...
Hartnett.
Yeah. Is a hockey player.
Yeah.
Live radio, folks.
Yes, it is.
He plays a love interest for Kirsten Dunst. The things culminate with the big homecoming dance the girls get to go to, and they all have dates. But, you know, essentially, these parents are so protective that, you know, the girls end up taking their lives rather than continuing to live this existence. And despite the heaviness of that, this is a beautiful film, both in terms of visuals and in terms of, it's just lyrical. It just, it pulls on your nostalgia from when you were younger and you were curious about the lives of people you saw at school but didn't know anything about. But it's about pain. It's about pain and loss and love and the mystery of this family of girls. I've seen this movie 3 times. I like it more every time I've seen it. What do you feel about Virgin Suicide?
I haven't seen it in forever, but it's one. If you're familiar with Sofia Coppola, like there's a mood that she puts you in almost a dreamlike state in nearly every movie that she makes, and it's. That's what I remember the most. I probably haven't seen this movie since it came out. But I just remember the mood that it sets all the way throughout. Like, I believe it's melancholy all the way through. It's one of those type of things. And I remember really liking this too. I will need to revisit it, at some point. But this was an outstanding debut that, of course, led on to Lost in Translation, and I remember really liking this. So yeah, I think this is a solid choice. I think this works pretty well with it. It is probably an unconventional double feature, but I think it works really, really well. So
yeah. Well, and I will probably always have unconventional double features because, you know, if you were really running a movie theater and doing a double feature with Brick, you would run Chinatown. You're not stupid. That's going to make you the most money, and it's clearly an influence on this film.
Well, it's like in Donnie Darko, that one theater decided they were going to show Evil Dead and The Last Temptation of Christ, you know, as a double feature. So, you know, that, you know, might as well. I think that's what I like the most. I like going in a different direction from what everybody's thinking, because if it were easy to just come up with an exact match for this movie, then there's something missing, I think, from that. If you come up with the exact match.
One
that I thought of as if you want to have kids in high school, murder, all this type of stuff. My Own Private Idaho came to mind. When watching this, and also Cruel Intentions came to mind watching this. When kids are playing adults.
Yeah,
in My Own Private Idaho, they're definitely not playing adults. They're kids.
Yeah.
But Cruel Intentions, it's almost like they don't even need parents in that movie. You know, like they're just all self-sustaining.
Yeah.
I like The Virgin Suicides as a double feature for this.
All right.
That's good.
So next week's homework is the 2003 Western directed by Kevin Costner, Open Range, starring Kevin Costner, Robert Duvall, Diego Luna's in this, Michael Gambone is the villain, and he's fucking awesome. I have seen this movie many, many times. It's one of my favorites, but it still seems to fly under the radar for most. I think if you ask most people about Kevin Costner and Westerns, they would probably say Dances with Wolves, maybe even Wyatt Earp. But Open Range just kind of flew under the radar, and it is a slow burn that ends with a bang. Now, let's get to some questions. I think we have time.
Yeah.
Question.
I got something to say.
Oh!
answers.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
All right, so the first question here is, we know they will eventually do the X-Men in the MCU. They will likely recast every single role. I'm glad this question asker did not ask for the full roster, because that would take an hour.
I am too. Yep.
Pick one or two and give me your best casting choice.
Mm-hmm. Looking at which ones you did, I went with Charles Xavier. I'm going to go with Bryan Cranston on that one.
That's a good one.
Basically, I just kind of took a look at the comic drawings of these characters so that I wasn't being influenced by the fact that you have Patrick Stewart and James McAvoy playing the character. I look back at some of the comic drawings and everything, and Bryan Cranston came to mind on that one for some reason. So, you know, for many X-Men fans, that's probably like blasphemy, but that's what it looked like to me. So,
no, I think that's a good pick. We know we can do bald.
Mm-hmm, that's true. That's true. For Jean Grey, I have Sydney Sweeney for that one.
The girl from Euphoria?
Yeah, she's from Euphoria. I think it's, you know, you first you're like, oh, well, who's a smoking redhead that we could put in as Jean Grey?
And, right. You like know, hair dye doesn't exist.
Right. Exactly. There's no conformed look of Jean Grey in the comics, because I went through a whole bunch of images and, like, you know, she looks one way in this one series. And then I think there's a whole comic series that's just called Jean Grey.
Oh,
where
wow.
She's got this short red hair bob of some sort. And I was like, wow, it'd be kind of cool if I could come up with someone there, but I couldn't really. So the consensus in my brain there, Sydney Sweeney for Jean Grey.
I like that. So. I like that. She's she's also in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but it's a fairly small role.
Yeah, she goes over and gives Dakota Fanning like some updates of what Brad Pitt's doing, and that's about it.
All right, so I decided to go with Storm, not because I like that character. Because I don't, but because I like this actress, Amanda Stenberg, who played Rue in Hunger Games and played the main character in The Hate U Give.
Mm-hmm.
Really good actress, really charming, engaging performer.
And
then I'll do some sacrilege here, and I'll cast Wolverine, and I'm going to put Ben Foster in that role, and I'm going to tell you why.
I'm down with it.
Alpha Dog taught me that Ben Foster could do Berserker Wolverine, because in Alpha Dog, he is menacing, but also constantly screaming and grunting. I think he's got lots of range for the quiet moments. I think he could bulk up, I just love him. I want to see Ben Foster in everything. But that was my pick. All right, on to another question. I was honestly thinking, with the power of the dog, where I could tell the acting, camera work, and storyline were all great in their own right, but I just couldn't buy into it. What is a movie like that for you?
Yeah, interesting. I don't know if I saw anybody who liked Power of the Dog in any of the comments that I saw.
Yeah, it seemed to be not a favorite of the group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I recall when I first started watching it, I was like, what the hell is this movie? I don't get it. What's going on? And it really just sort of grabbed me by the end of it. So, if you're one of those that can, if 30 minutes is not doing it for you, I can totally understand. This one, Nomadland for me, talking about great performances and incredible cinematography. I don't know about the storyline part of this, because there's not much of a storyline of Nomadland, but Nomadland just did not do it for me. I couldn't get involved in it at all. But I understood why it was good, why it was being praised. Movie won Best Picture. But it wasn't for me. That's just not a movie that I'm going to be watching over and over again.
That's a good answer. I'm going off book again with another Best Picture winner, The Shape of Water.
Yeah, yeah.
After it won Best Picture, and I am not typically a Guillermo del Toro fan. I recognize his work is almost always gorgeous. I'm trying to think what I like of his movies the most. Might be Hellboy. But when Shape of Water won Best Picture, I was like, well, I'm going to have to watch this thing. So I did. And just as the question says, I could tell the camera work was good. I could tell the acting was outstanding. I just didn't feel moved. I kept thinking about The Matrix for some reason. And I think it was visuals. But maybe I was distracted. I could see the quality. It just didn't connect with me. And I think that's the spirit of the question.
Guillermo del Toro also has a fascination with creatures in water tanks. And it's like that and the Hellboy movies. And even in Nightmare Alley, it's not the same thing, but I felt like it should be included because he's got like a baby in formaldehyde or something that shows up in this thing. So I'm like, God, man, you love your creatures in jars, don't you?
His agent calls, and Guillermo, I got a pitch for you. Is there any creature in a container of water? No. Okay. I pass.
Yeah, well, pass. Yeah, can't do that.
All right. I think we have time for a few more.
Yeah.
What actor whose switch in range surprised you the most? I guess it could just be actor whose range surprised you the most. And the answer from the question asker is Jim Carrey from Liar Liar to Man on the Moon.
Yeah, yep. That certainly was a big step for him because he went method on Man on the Moon. He really became Andy Kaufman, and they had the same birthday and everything. A lot of weird stuff about that. But for me, it's Bill Murray. Bill Murray made his career on this one particular type of comic character. I mean, except for Caddyshack, he's usually the wise ass character of any movie that he was in. When he did Rushmore, that's where I was like, whoa, he's really different. And then Lost in Translation and Broken Flowers and on now at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I'd only known him as this one thing for a really long time. I guess in The Man Who Knew Too Little, he's not like a wise ass in that. He's basically he's just a dumbass. But for the most part, that's what we knew Bill Murray from. And to see him in Rushmore, that was an incredible leap for me in his acting skill.
Yeah, I wanted to go with Andrew Garfield because Andrew Garfield is my homie now after Tick, Tick, Boom, and I just want to answer Andrew Garfield for everything.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go with Zendaya. Zendaya.
Oh, yeah.
I'm still not sure how to say her name. I first knew her when she first was coming on my radar. It was that she had been cast in Spider-Man, and she was a model, singer, and former Disney actress.
Mm-hmm.
And then I watched the first season of Euphoria after having seen the first Spider-Man movie. And that girl can act. I have stopped watching season 2 of Euphoria at this point. It's just a little too much for me.
Fucking brutal.
And I'm not sure I want to take that journey anymore. I'm happy to read about it the next day. But I watched the first 4 episodes of this season, and she's still killing it as an actress. And I never expected that at all. It's like it's like Britney Spears being cast in Crossroads and then being Meryl Streep all of a sudden. Like, it came out of nowhere for me.
And I'll add to this, you haven't seen these episodes, nor am I saying you should, but the ones that have come after those 4, the one where she is for the first 10 minutes of that episode is just in this manic, angry state all the way through. She probably says fuck more than she has ever said in her life in that one scene. And it's draining. It's draining to watch. I can only imagine what it was like to actually be in that character at that moment. Those are the one, that's the sort of the easy one where you're like, oh my God, can she shout good? You know, there's a lot of shouting going on. But then in the next episode after that, where she's sort of doing the withdrawal thing and the whole, she's trying to get back to normal and everything. That's where I think you can see the mark of a great actor there, because right after an episode like that we saw previous, where she has come down and this is where she is there and she can still pull you in. That's an incredible job she's doing on that. I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, more and more as she gets more complex roles over the years. So.
Yeah. I also want to point out in the comments, Josh said Kevin James in Becky. That's 100% a good
that's
answer.
That's totally right. Yes.
I never thought he had that in him. And then another one that I saw here that I wanted to point out. Channing Tatum being suddenly hilarious.
Yeah, Channing Tatum, because he'd been in like all these Step Up movies, and he'd been in Dear John and all that, and then 21 Jump Street. Fuck you, science. Yeah, I love that
you,
shit.
Science.
I love that shit. So yeah, I'm Ryan Gosling. You see, Gosling. That's the thing. I think he sort of more and more turned into a comic actor after a while. Like, you know, we all knew that he could do the serious stuff. That if you, your first movie that you ever saw him in probably was Murder by Numbers, probably, if you saw it. And we knew he was good then. And he's in a lot of, like, just very straight dramas for a while. But we started seeing him, like, you know, he's just, you can see that he's just underneath, he's got some real funny, he's got a funny bone in him, and The Big Short is where he really, like, that's where the culmination of all of that. I think in The Big Short, that's my favorite performance of his.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And then he did, God, my brain is not functioning today. The movie with Russell Crowe and the detective thing. That's hilarious.
The Nice Guys.
The Nice Guys. That was where I think for me, that's the funniest I think I've seen him.
Oh, he's unbelievable in that.
All right,
Russell Crowe might even be the funniest he's ever been there.
Oh, that's a good point, because he doesn't do much comedy at all.
Nope.
But he was hilarious in that freaking
movie. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so I will ask this question, and then we'll wrap it up.
Okay.
I think we both have a similar answer for this, but I think it's worth at least expounding on. The question is, what do you look for in a new movie that makes it bond to your soul and become an all-time favorite? Is it the writing, particularly impressive cinematography, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, I don't go into any movie like, it better have this or I don't like it. It's not to that point. It's so many different
some kind of creature suspended in a water tank.
Yeah, exactly, right? You know, there's always something that of movies that I really 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 enjoy that infest my soul or whatever. That They had different kinds of things. I'm a big plot guy. If you give me an intricate plot where tiny details lead up to big details and everything like that, and it's done in a satisfying manner, typically really like it. But I was thinking of, you know, a movie that isn't generally like unanimously well regarded, like Death Proof, where there's a scene where Kurt Russell's talking to Vanessa Ferlito outside the bar. And he does that whole like poem that he's supposed to do so that she'll do the lap dance for him. And just that whole scene outside drew me into Death Proof. Like that's the part if I pop in Death Proof, that's the scene that I'm like just waiting to gravitate towards. In City of God, it's, you know, the kids, the kids becoming gangsters and it's told through the lens of this guy who wants to be a photographer. Everything about City of God just turns, like, that movie is just dynamic filmmaking all the way through. Story, cinematography, dialogue, just great little scenes. It's an epic film. It's just one of those things. And in The Godfather, I talked about plot. Godfather's got those little plot details that lead to certain big actions later on in the movie. So I don't have any one thing that I'm looking for. I've seen a lot of great cinematography on movies that are not good. That didn't draw me in. So it's not that. I've seen movies with great soundtracks that aren't very good. You know, it's usually some element of story that I like.
I will say there are two things here. First of all, it has to end. Because I have fallen in love with movies partway through, like AI, artificial intelligence, that then just refuse to end.
Yeah,
and they
just
keep going and ruin the whole experience. Or that irresistible movie with Steve Carell where 90% of it is charming political dramedy, and then it takes a left turn into the sun at the end.
Yeah.
So I wait till the movie's done before I even consider if this is a movie that's going to bond to my soul. But the true test is just how long it stays in my head. How long do I spend thinking about it after I've seen it? How often do I find myself discussing it, like Gone Baby Gone, or like you said, City of God, or Parasite? More I find a movie just living in my head and has me chewing on it and pondering it and wondering what I can learn from it, that is how I know a movie is bonded to my soul, is I can't stop thinking.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, live chat, for once again bringing it today. Yep. You got a lot of like answers in there that we normally wouldn't. So
good stuff.
So it's I think you're a big enhancer to the show. So, but that's going to do it. We'll see you guys next time. Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Eating my breakfast and alternating between the Coke and the coffee, and I'm like, I forgot to put sugar in this coffee. But I actually hadn't. I had already sugared it. Mm-hmm. It's just that the Coke was so sweet, it made the coffee taste unsweet. I finished the Coke first, still had half the coffee left, and by the time I was finishing the coffee, it tasted too sweet. So there was a relativity to the sweetness of sugared drinks, and I'm going to explore and see if it extends to brownies and other edible delectables. All right, I am recording on Audition. Audition? Audible. Audition. Hi, I'm Chris Atkinson.
Yeah. And I'm Jeremy Scott.
Nice.
Any questions?
Any questions? Did you watch any shitty Dwayne The Rock Johnson movies this morning?
Not this morning, no. That is usually what I do, though.
Right, yeah, some people wake and bake, but you wake and rock.
Mm-hmm. That's right, that's right. What would be the equivalent of 420 for a rock movie? 658, I don't know. I mean, there's still Rampage. I haven't seen that, so you can always do that, too.
Have you really not seen Rampage?
Mm-mm.
You saw the helicopter earthquake one, right? San Andreas?
No, I didn't see that either.
Oh, my God. You got some homework there because, I mean, Skyscraper is by far the worst of those three. But, you know, those other two are... It's like the difference between a D and an F, really. It's like... oh, God. Rampage is... I want you to make a YouTube video of you reacting live to Rampage. Patrick thinks we're starting at 11. He doesn't realize we have 15 minutes. He's like, are they running late?
What a dick Patrick is. Yeah, California Love. I was actually wondering if they were going to like dust off the Tupac hologram for that.
Apparently that had been rumored. And I haven't seen the Tupac hologram, but apparently people hate that.
It's not, I don't think it was well received.
I remember they made a commercial for a vacuum with Fred Astaire dancing with the vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
This was like in the 90s, I think. And Fred Astaire's estate got all pissed because they hadn't asked for permission or whatever. And they were like, he's dead. Yeah. You know, let him stay dead. That's kind of how I feel about Tupac, unless he's not dead. But at this point, if he's still alive, he's not coming back.
He left a lot of clues that he's not.
I don't know much about that, except that there's a conspiracy theory.
It's what people read into with everything that comes out. Like, he came out with that that Machiavelli album or whatever, and everybody's like, Machiavelli faked his own death.
Type
of thing.
I see.
Or he wrote about it or something. I don't know.
Dark Side of the Moon lines up perfectly with Wizard of Oz.
Even though it doesn't in many cases.
Even though it doesn't. Our brains are really powerful. Like, to overcome sheer logic that strongly, it's just fascinating to me because everybody not everybody. Most people have something silly that they kind of think might be true, like Bigfoot or Loch Ness Monster or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Remember when we were young and the Bermuda Triangle was like nightmare-inducing? Like,
yeah.
I lived in fear of ever going near the Bermuda Triangle. I haven't heard a thing about that for 20 years.
Yeah, I know.
Science ruining all the conspiracies one at a time. Fucking science. Yeah.
You know what's weird to me is I knew that flat earthers were a thing and they believed the earth were flat was flat, but I didn't realize how far they've taken it.
Mm.
I knew that they had gone a long way to debunk everything that they see, but I didn't realize they had invented a whole other type of thing.
Like giant ice wall that surrounds the flat planet that you can't get over, and that's why.
Yeah, and that NASA has people there to make sure that nobody ever goes to Antarctica so that the secret is kept.
Right.
And and I was watching a flat earth debunk video that showed how the flat earthers think in one of their own videos showing in this video. And like, they were showing like how Earth and the sun and all the planets are sitting here doing this like curly fry formation type of thing to explain why the flat earth still exists. And I was like, God damn, guys, seriously, Occam's razor.
I kept expecting somebody to say, scram.
Yeah, exactly. Get out of here, kid. You bother me.